From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I'm here today to establish a productive, collaborative, and energetic partnership to invest in the people of Chicago and the engine of this economy here in Illinois. Because pundits and cynics don't always see it that way, do they? But it's a new day for Chicago, and it's a new day for the state of Illinois. For years, they've told us that this is a zero-sum game, that if something is good for Chicago, well, that means we're taking something away from Peoria. They've tried to frame this as a choice, but I'm here to deliver an emphatic message today. It is a false choice. No one has to lose at the expense of someone else winning. There's more than enough for everybody in the state of Illinois.
Chicago's mayor-elect came to the Illinois State House this week. Brandon Johnson addressed a joint session of the Illinois General Assembly. He called for unity. We'll discuss what he had to say. And as the legislature gets set for its stretch run toward adjournment in May, we'll discuss what is left to do. That and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and with us we have Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And with us today we have Alex Degman, a State House reporter for WBEZ, and he covers the beat for Illinois public radio stations as well. Alex, always good to have you back with us.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So you were there, Brandon Johnson was there at the Capitol this week. Fill us in on his appearance. What was the mood? What all did he have to say? We heard a little bit there at the start of the show.
Yeah, I think the clip that you played pretty well encapsulates the tone that he tried to convey for most of the day. And he was in town for a couple of days, meeting with people ahead of his inauguration on May 15th. But like you heard him mention that prosperity doesn't have to be a zero-sum game, because there's always been this, at least as long as I've been around, there has been this divide between Chicago and downstate. And there's been this idea that because Chicago gets things, the rest of downstate doesn't get anything. And he's really trying to push back against that, which is not necessarily surprising, because when you have Chicago politicians coming down to talk to a big group of people, you want to try to strike that conciliatory tone. It worked for some people. I noticed in the chamber that a lot of his remarks were taken in stride, and they were really well received by all of the Democrats, with standing ovations many times. But most of the House Republicans, they would respond a couple of times when he would talk about support for law enforcement, but largely they seemed disinterested. And in fact, the Illinois House Freedom Caucus was not in attendance at all. Some of the things that he talked about, you know, just being a symbiotic relationship. Downstate grows the food. Downstate has all the space that's going to produce the energy for things like O'Hare Airport in the city, with like solar farms and wind farms and things like that. But then he also what I was kind of hoping that he would get a little bit more into, but he didn't, was what the state can do to help Chicago specifically. And I guess, as you mentioned, we're in budget season. I was hoping to hear more about what he would like to see from the state in terms of financial help for the things that he wants to accomplish. One of the things, obviously, we're talking about is rising crime. That is going to be a problem in the Johnson administration, and he knows that. But what he wants to do with the state is work on some sort of a collaborative approach, but we're not quite sure what that looks like yet. Multiple times we wanted to know from him, you know, what does that state ask look like? If you want to hire 200 more police detectives, if you want to expand mental health care resources to police officers, what does the state need to do that? And it's unclear yet. Right now he's in a so-called collaborative mode, and he doesn't want to be seen as somebody who's up there making demands. He wants to let the process play out, I suppose.
Charlie, what did you take away from what you heard from the new or incoming mayor of Chicago?
Well, I think that what Alex said is hits the nail on the head. He wants to be very collaborative, and he tried to stress over and over that, as he said, this is not a zero-sum game. that all parts of Illinois can prosper and move ahead, and that's what he's interested in doing. One of the things I found interesting was that in terms of talking about what the state could do to help Chicago financially, was that the mayor-elect seized upon an idea that's been floating around for years, pushed by the Illinois Municipal League, that argues that localities, cities and towns should get 10% of the state's income tax returns instead of the roughly 6% they're getting now. And that's based on the historical fact that 50 some years ago, when Richard Ogilvie proposed, this was in 69, when Richard Ogilvie proposed an income tax, first time ever in the state of Illinois, Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley was key to enabling its passage. And he cut a deal with Ogilvie that in return for him putting the machine Democrats on the bill in the Senate and the House, the city of Chicago and all the other municipalities in the state of Illinois would get 10% of the take. And over the years, over, say, the last 20 years, that's been gradually reduced. And as the state has increased its income tax rate from the original 3%, the localities did not get 10% of the new money coming in. And so, although in terms of absolute dollars, they're getting a lot more than they did back in 69, they are not getting 10% of the new take. And so Mayor-elect Johnson endorsed that idea and said that that's something that should happen. And he also argued that there should be more money put into the evidence-based school funding formula, which obviously would help Chicago, but also would help, I'm guessing, I'll just throw out a ballpark, probably 700 other school districts across the state of Illinois, where their needs, as calculated by this evidence-based formula, aren't adequate with their own local resources, and the state is supposed to make up the difference. But the state funds are not sufficient to make up the difference. And Governor Pritzker has proposed putting in an additional $350 million for next fiscal year. The advocates are arguing that it should be at least $550 million. And even at that rate, it'll take us 10, 12 years to get to where the schools are fully funded according to their needs based on this evidence-based formula. So in that sense, he was supporting cities, villages, local governments across the state with his argument that the local government distributed fund should be funded at 10% of the state income tax. And he was also addressing the needs of school districts across the state in arguing that there should be more money put into the school funding. So in that sense, he was, I think, trying to reach out to the state. He was not really specific on a lot of other issues, as Alex suggested, particularly in the specifics of how is he going to deal with the violence problem in Chicago? How is he going to be able to fund the things that he's asking for? Now, some of the things he suggested, for example, he wants to put a tax on high-end real estate transactions to help pay for homeless services. That requires the legislature's cooperation. So we'll see going forward how well that stuff plays out.
Now, while he is going to be new to the office of Chicago mayor, he is not completely oblivious to how state government works, Alex. He has had some background there. He even worked, I guess, for a period for Don Harmon, the Senate president. So he has some ties to Springfield and to the legislature, and he also has an understanding of how this process goes.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that is part of the reason that he wanted to make this introduction so close to his inauguration, just to get out there when people are making these asks, when they are talking about budget needs and things like that. Because as we get into these last few weeks, there are going to be a lot of people with a lot of asks, and a lot of these people are going to be seeing the numbers that we all are seeing as well. And those are the COGFA estimates, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, showing, you know, time and again, we've got more revenue than was estimated. So where does all of that go? And this is now what we're seeing. We're seeing a lot of people come into the fray, like Brandon Johnson, and start making those requests.
Well, Charlie, everybody, I think most everybody in the state legislature understands that Chicago is important to the state. Certainly, there are people who feel maybe it gets a little too much attention or maybe at the expense of other locations, including especially downstate and far downstate. People feel that way at times. But overall, he's meeting a pretty receptive group of majority Democrats, including supermajority Democrats in the Illinois legislature coming in. You were recently quoted, though, in an article talking about how the position of Chicago mayor is not quite as important to state government as it once was. So it doesn't carry as much weight in Springfield as it once did. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, I already alluded to the fact that when Richard Ogilvie in 1969 wanted an income tax, he needed Richard J. Daley, the Chicago mayor, to make it happen. And Daley was able to put Democrats, machine Democrats, on that bill. And a lot of them weren't happy about it. I didn't cover it. That was actually, believe it or not, before my time by a matter of months. But they did it because they had their marching orders. And I covered the Constitutional Convention, and Daley wanted four things out of the convention, and he got them all. He wanted to legalize, if you will, the fact that Cook County classified real estate for property tax purposes, despite what the law or the Constitution said, the old Constitution seemed to say. He got that. He wanted to keep elected judges. He got that. He wanted to keep cumulative voting. He got that. And he wanted home rule, which he also got. And when the Constitution was approved, it was approved, the winning majority for the Constitution back in 1971 came from the city of Chicago. And back then, the majority of the Democrats in the legislature were from the city, and most of them were regular organization Democrats. There were a few independents here and there along the lakefront, but most of them were what would be called machine Democrats. And times change. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm willing to bet most of the Democrats in the legislature today, and there are between the Senate and the House, there's 118 of them. Most of them are not from the city of Chicago. Most of them are from the suburbs. And that's reflected a change in the ability of the Chicago mayor, plus the changes in the laws and the court cases that said you no longer have political patronage. You can't give a guy a job based on how valuable he is to the machine. That has made it harder for the Democratic Party to have the control that once upon a time it did. So because of these changes, the mayor does not have nearly the clout that he did back then. And that's was certainly true in the case of outgoing Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who kind of got off on the wrong foot from the beginning. And as a matter of fact, the majority Democrats on a couple issues did exactly what she did not want. Rahm Emanuel wasn't all that successful either compared to the former mayor's Daley. So times have changed, and the mayor is still, what would you say, he's still the most important mayor in the state, but he does not have the same kind of clout that predecessors did.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler and Alex Degman. Alex, as you mentioned, we are creeping closer to the scheduled adjournment in May. In fact, I believe it's May 19th that the state legislature has set for adjournment this year, earlier than the previous final day of May that they always did for many years and sometimes blew past that. Does everything seem to be on course for getting out at that time and getting all of this done? As you mentioned, the budget still has to get approved.
Well, Sean, I gave up trying to prognosticate that a while ago. But what I will say is that there doesn't really seem to be a whole lot of steam under people's shoes just yet, if that reference even makes sense. People aren't running around like crazy yet. But there have been a lot of people that have been coming to the Capitol this session, and it's starting to increase in recent weeks, especially. I think we're now back into the point at the state capitol where people are coming in droves again. People are coming down for advocacy days. They're coming down to rally. They're coming down by the busloads to make their voices heard. And I haven't really seen this a lot since before the pandemic. So it's starting to get a little busy in that sense. And like I mentioned a few minutes ago, people are paying attention to what is going on with the state budget. They're paying attention to the fact that revenues are good right now, as you know, we've been told, with credit rating upgrades here, money into the rainy day fund there. We've got new initiatives coming here. People are seeing this, and this is a pretty big year for, for example, union negotiations. A lot of state union workers are in contract negotiations right now. So they're going to be seeing these revenue numbers, and they're going to be wondering, okay, what can we get out of this? And then you can also see it in people like the mayor of Chicago. The mayor-elect is coming down talking about priorities. Those are going to need money. You've got healthcare people. You've got education folks. Everybody wants a slice of what is now a growing pie, but obviously they're not all going to get everything that they want, because that would obviously unbalance the budget. Illinois is one of the few states, there's only a handful of states in the country that actually allow budget deficits to be carried over from one budget year to the next. And that's happened. It's Illinois. I think it's fair to say that budgeting has not been the state's best strong suit in recent years. But recently, I don't think there's much of an appetite to have an unbalanced budget. Even if it eventually happens, that's not the goal. So, I say that went by just looking at how people are talking about the budget these days. We're talking very proudly. The state's talking very proudly about credit rating upgrades. They're talking very proudly about increased revenues from things that have been implemented in the past, cannabis, for example. And they're just talking about how the budget has been balanced for a while. And I don't think that there's an appetite, especially with upcoming growing pressures on state budgets. I don't think that there's going to be necessarily an appetite to do anything unbalanced.
Well, Alex mentioned labor negotiations. Certainly labor negotiations on college campuses have been a real issue here in the last few weeks. In fact, at one point, there were three public university faculty and staff unions that were on strike at the same time. That was Governor State, Eastern Illinois, Chicago State. And I don't recall seeing that, certainly in the time I've been following higher education in Illinois. The strikes have now been suspended after tentative agreements were reached. And Charlie, you're a former professor, and I know that there's some differences on each campus, but what do you think is the root of a lot of what has been going on here with these strikes and with these labor disputes?
Well, I think a lot of it goes back to something that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. There was a report that came out from the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability that said when you adjust for inflation, the state universities have basically lost roughly half of the funding of the buying power that they had in 2002. And in 2002, which would have been, 21 years ago, state funding accounted for about 72% of the revenue for the state universities. The rest came from tuition and fees. In 2021, only 36% came from the state, 64% came from tuition and fees. And so that was a situation where the state, basically we had a series of governors who really didn't care about higher ed as much as their predecessors had. And so the funding was cut for universities. And at the same time, the tuition was increased. University administrators had to figure out a way, how can we give annual salary increases or pay bumps to faculty and our staff and all the people who do all the work around a university to make it possible for people like me to stand in a classroom and pontificate? How do we make it? How can we support it? Well, we'll have to raise tuition because the state sure isn't helping us. And then the tuition has increased dramatically in a place like U of I in Champaign. That's not a big deal because they also have outside funds that can help them. But some of the others, the increases are just really difficult. I was going to say, and even though there's been increases in the MAP grants, the monetary assistance program, they still don't help a lot of low-income kids get to school. Back 20 years ago, the MAP grant, the average MAP grant, was roughly 48% of the average tuition and fees at a four-year university. 20 years later, it only covers about 19%. And so if you're a first-time college student from a lower-income family, your ability to go to school is going to be severely constrained. And so to get back to the original point, the faculty at these three universities were striking, hoping that they could get a better deal for themselves in terms of workload, in terms of salary. And as a matter of fact, the three that settled at Governor State, Chicago State, and Eastern they're in the process, the faculty unions are in the process of ratifying those contracts, and I expect that they will be. Meanwhile, bargaining is also going on between the administrators and the faculty at Northeastern Illinois University up on the northwest side of Chicago. And last week they voted to authorize a strike, and they've asked for mediation. And so they're going down the same road for the same reasons, I would say.
Well, in the time we have left, let's focus on a piece of legislation that I saw is moving through the legislature. And Alex, this one involves something that's become quite similar, or quite familiar, I should say. Over the past few years, we've seen different bills move through and become law that require a certain chapter in history to be taught for different groups. One was Asian American history. That started this year in Illinois schools. Now, this one would require Native American history be taught and make sure that people understand the contributions that Native Americans have played in the state of Illinois and U.S. history. But also, it strikes me that this patchwork approach, that there might be a better way to do it.
Yeah, and I think you'll find that a lot of education officials and a lot of education experts would agree with you on that. This one is this one specifically, and you outlined what it essentially does, but it would start with the 24-25 school year. When we're talking about the patchwork, supposedly education advocates are a little worried that this is a lot all at once. There are a lot of mandates that are, you know, not necessarily bad. It's not a bad thing to teach about Asian American history, and it's certainly not bad to teach about Native American history either. But the fact is, these are mandates, and these are things that districts are now going to have to figure out how to implement. So this program where Native American contributions would be studied in government, arts, humanities, sciences, things like that, in grades 6 through 12, it would also require that school districts teach a section on the genocide of Native Americans and the discrimination that they face and still face today. But there are concerns about how to implement this, who is going to implement this, who is going to have the time to go and make sure that these curricula are up to speed. And what I thought was particularly interesting about this one is that there are a lot of proponents, obviously, that filed for this bill. Only a couple of opponents, but there was one neutral filing on this bill in particular, and that was the Illinois State Board of Education. ISBE usually, and I actually don't want to say usually, but ISBE in the past has been against mandates specifically for the reason of it's a mandate, we don't know how we're going to do it. They're specifically against the bill that would require financial literacy in high schools. That's another example of an education mandate that's moving. But this one, they're neutral. They're usually not neutral on these. So that leads me to believe that they're probably not going to stand in the way of this one.
Charlie, also, there's some other legislation dealing with Native Americans you were following as well. You want to fill us in on that?
For decades, 30 years or more, the Native American nations have been asking the state of Illinois and its state-run institutions, universities, the state museum, to return the remains of their ancestors for reburial within the state. And the state of Illinois has been dragging its feet, to be charitable, in doing so. But the legislation that is now passed the House 108-0 last month, and it's now in the Senate, and it would require remains of thousands of Native Americans to be repatriated. There was an investigation by ProPublica that I think it was in January it was announced, and they found out that institutions have not returned the remains of more than 15,000 Native Americans who were excavated from Illinois. The Illinois State Museum, for example, for decades had displayed open Native American graves at Dixon Mounds. That burial site was built as a tourist attraction, and it was finally closed in the 90s. And so the legislation by State Representative Mark Walker, who is from Arlington Heights, a Democrat, said that he introduced the bill after leaders of the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation brought his brought the issue to his attention. And he said it's atrocious that museums and universities still keep human remains and funerary items. And one of his quotes in the story from ProPublica was, "I don't know what right we have to dig up somebody's grandmother."
All right, let's go to our notes from the field. Alex, we'll go to you first.
Yeah, there was a pretty interesting piece of legislation that surfaced this week regarding the Bears. The Tribune had a story about a new piece of legislation from Marty Moylan, a Des Plaines Democrat, that would essentially put a $3 per ticket tax on tickets that are sold at the new stadium complex if it gets built. And that would help mainly the city of Chicago offset the cost to renovate Soldier Field, because there's a thought that the Bears are still going to be on the hook for some of the debt that was incurred 20 years ago when those renovations were done. And then there would be another pool of revenue that was generated that would go to some of the other surrounding suburbs around it, like Arlington Heights, Rolling Meadows, and then to a lesser extent, places like Buffalo Grove, Prospect Heights, Wheeling, places like that.
Okay. And Charlie.
Well, as we discussed earlier, we've got about another month to go in the legislature, and there are a ton of bills. There's been, last count, there were 6,600 bills, more than 6,600 bills introduced. Of those 6,600, maybe a couple hundred at most will actually become law in this first year. But one that is moving along and seems to have a pretty good chance of becoming law is a bill that would ban the use of polystyrene, you know, styrofoam, by retail establishments. The House approved it 67-43. It's awaiting a vote in the Senate now. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says Americans are estimated to throw away roughly 70 million plastic foam cups every day. And this stuff lasts for hundreds of years. It clogs landfills. You can see it going down the street, you see stuff thrown out the window. And this bill would make Illinois the very first Midwestern state to ban polystyrene takeout.
That's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Alex Degman with WBEZ and Illinois Public Radio. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app and iTunes. Just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, and join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.